Give me the letter. Hardly had Rostov handed the general the letter and finished explaining Denisov's case, when hasty steps and the jingling of spurs were heard on the stairs, and the general, leaving him, went to the porch. The gentlemen of the Emperor's suite ran down the stairs and went to their horses. Hayne, the same groom who had been at Austerlitz, led up the Emperor's horse, and the faint creak of a footstep Rostov knew at once was heard on the stairs. Forgetting the danger of being recognized, Rostov went close to the porch, together with some inquisitive civilians, and again, after 2 years, saw those features he adored, that same face and same look and step, and the same union of majesty and mildness. And the feeling of enthusiasm and love for his sovereign rose again in Rostov's soul in all its old force. In the uniform of the Preobrazhensk regiment, white chamois leather breeches and high boots, and wearing a star Rostov did not know, it was that of the Legion d'Honneur, the monarch came out into the porch, putting on his gloves and carrying his hat under his arm. He stopped and looked about him, brightening everything around by his glance. He spoke a few words to some of the generals, and, recognizing the former commander of Rostov's division, smiled and beckoned to him. All the suite drew back, and Rostov saw the general talking for some time to the emperor. The emperor said a few words to him and took a step toward his horse. Again the crowd of members of the suite and street gazers, among whom was Rostov, moved nearer to the emperor. Stopping beside his horse, with his hand on the saddle, the emperor turned to the cavalry general and said in a loud voice, evidently wishing to be heard by all, "I cannot do it, general. I cannot, because the law is stronger than I." And he raised his foot to the stirrup. The general bowed his head respectfully, and the monarch mounted and rode down the street at a gallop. Beside himself with enthusiasm, Rostov ran after him with the crowd. Chapter 18. Napoleon and Alexander as allies. Perplexity of Nicholas. Another bottle. The emperor rode to the square, where, facing one another, a battalion of the Preobrazhensk regiment stood on the right, and a battalion of the French guards in their bearskin caps on the left. As the Tsar rode up to one flank of the battalions, which presented arms, another group of horsemen galloped up to the opposite flank, and at the head of them Rostov recognized Napoleon. It could be no one else. He came at a gallop, wearing a small hat, a blue uniform open over a white vest, and the St. Andrew ribbon over his shoulder. He was riding a very fine, thoroughbred gray Arab horse with a crimson, gold-embroidered saddle cloth. On approaching Alexander, he raised his hat, and as he did so, Rostov, with his cavalryman's eye, could not help noticing that Napoleon did not sit well or firmly in the saddle. The battalion shouted, "Hurrah!" and "Vive l'Empereur!" Napoleon said something to Alexander, and both emperors dismounted and took each other's hands. Napoleon's face wore an unpleasant and artificial smile. Alexander was saying something affable to him. In spite of the trampling of the French gendarmes' horses, which were pushing back the crowd, Rostov kept his eyes on every movement of Alexander and Bonaparte. It struck him as a surprise that Alexander treated Bonaparte as an equal, and that the latter was quite at ease with the Tsar, as if such relations with an emperor were an everyday matter to him. Alexander and Napoleon, with the long train of their suites, approached the right flank of the Preobrazhensk battalion and came straight up to the crowd standing there. The crowd unexpectedly found itself so close to the emperor's that Rostov, standing in the front row, was afraid he might be recognized. "Sire, I ask your permission to present the Legion of Honor to the bravest of your soldiers," said a sharp, precise voice, articulating every letter. This was said by the undersized Napoleon, looking up straight into Alexander's eyes. Alexander listened attentively to what was said to him, and, bending his head, smiled pleasantly. "To him who has borne himself most bravely in this last war," added Napoleon, accentuating each syllable, as with a composure and assurance exasperating to Rostov, he ran his eyes over the Russian ranks drawn up before him, who all presented arms with their eyes fixed on their emperor. "Will your majesty allow me to consult the colonel?" said Alexander, and took a few hasty steps toward Prince Kozlovsky, the commander of the battalion. Bonaparte, meanwhile, began taking the glove off his small white hand, tore it in doing so, and threw it away. An aide-de-camp behind him rushed forward and picked it up. "To whom shall it be given?" the Emperor Alexander asked Kozlovsky in Russian, in a low voice. "To whomever your majesty commands." The emperor knit his brows with dissatisfaction, and glancing back remarked, "But we must give him an answer." Kozlovsky scanned the ranks resolutely, and included Rostov in his scrutiny. "Can it be me?" thought Rostov.
"Lazarev,"
the colonel called with a frown. And Lazarev, the first soldier in the ranks, stepped briskly forward.
"Where are you off to? Stop here!"
voices whispered to Lazarev, who did not know where to go. Lazarev stopped, casting a sidelong look at his colonel in alarm. His face twitched, as often happens to soldiers called before the ranks. Napoleon slightly turned his head and put his plump little hand out behind him as if to take something. The members of his suite, guessing at once what he wanted, moved about and whispered as they passed something from one to another, and a page, the same one Rostov had seen the previous evening at Boris's, ran forward and, bowing respectfully over the outstretched hand, and not keeping it waiting a moment, laid in it an order on a red ribbon. Napoleon, without looking, pressed two fingers together, and the badge was between them. Then he approached Lazarev, who rolled his eyes and persistently gazed at his own monarch, looked round at the Emperor Alexander to imply that what he was now doing was done for the sake of his ally, and the small white hand holding the order touched one of Lazarev's buttons. It was as if Napoleon knew that it was only necessary for his hand to deign to touch that soldier's breast for the soldier to be forever happy, rewarded, and distinguished from everyone else in the world. Napoleon merely laid the cross on Lazarev's breast, and dropping his hand, turned toward Alexander as though sure that the cross would adhere there. And it really did. Officious hands, Russian and French, immediately seized the cross and fastened it to the uniform. Lazarev glanced morosely at the little man with white hands who was doing something to him, and, still standing motionless, presenting arms, looked again straight into Alexander's eyes, as if asking whether he should stand there, or go away, or do something else. But receiving no orders, he remained for some time in that rigid position. The emperors remounted and rode away. The Preobrazhensk battalion, breaking rank, mingled with the French guards, and sat down at the tables prepared for them. Lazarev sat in the place of honor. Russian and French officers embraced him, congratulated him, and pressed his hands. Crowds of officers and civilians drew near merely to see him. A rumble of Russian and French voices and laughter filled the air round the tables in the square. Two officers with flushed faces, looking cheerful and happy, passed by Rostov.
"What do you think of the treat?" "All on silver plate," one of them was saying. "Have you seen Lazarev?"
"I have.
Tomorrow, I hear, the Preobrazhenskys will give them a dinner."
"Yes, but what luck for Lazarev. 1,200 francs pension for life."
"Here's a cap, lads," shouted a Preobrazhensk soldier, donning a shaggy French cap. "It's a fine thing, first rate."
"Have you heard the password?" asked one guards officer of another. "The day before yesterday it was Napoléon, France, bravoure. Yesterday, Alexandre, Russie, grandeur. One day our emperor gives it, and next day Napoleon.
Tomorrow our emperor will send a St. George's cross to the bravest of the French guards. It has to be done. He must respond in kind."
Note. Tolstoy's description of the meeting of the emperors at Tilsit keeps very close to history, though he does not mention the humiliation inflicted on the King of Prussia, who was not invited into the tent where the emperors met, but during their two-hour interview stood with Alexander's courtier, Prince P. M. Volkonsky, waiting on the bank of the Niemen like a punished schoolboy and hardly saying anything. It was only at Alexander's request that Napoleon received the King of Prussia next day. Tolstoy also omits to mention that the Preobrazhensk regiment was unable to return the hospitality to the French guards in equal style, as they had no silver plate, and despite Alexander's readiness to pay highly for it, could not obtain any. Boris, too, with his friend Zhilinsky, came to see the Preobrazhensk banquet. On his way back, he noticed Rostov standing by the corner of the house.
"Rostov, how do you do? We missed one another," he said, and could not refrain from asking what was the matter, so strangely dismal and troubled was Rostov's face.
"Nothing, nothing," replied Rostov. "You'll call round?"
"Yes, I will."
Rostov stood at that corner for a long time, watching the feast from a distance. In his mind, a painful process was going on, which he could not bring to a conclusion. Terrible doubts rose in his soul. Now he remembered Denisov with his changed expression, his submission, and the whole hospital, with arms and legs torn off, and its dirt and disease. So vividly did he recall that hospital stench of dead flesh that he looked round to see where the smell came from. Next he thought of that self-satisfied Bonaparte with his small white hand, who was now an emperor, liked and respected by Alexander. Then, why those severed arms and legs, and those dead men? Then again he thought of Lazarev, rewarded, and Denisov, punished and unpardoned. He caught himself harboring such strange thoughts that he was frightened. The smell of the food the Preobrazhenskys were eating and a sense of hunger recalled him from these reflections. He had to get something to eat before going away. He went to a hotel he had noticed that morning. There he found so many people, among them officers who, like himself, had come in civilian clothes, that he had difficulty in getting a dinner. Two officers of his own division joined him. The conversation naturally turned on the peace. The officers, his comrades, like most of the army, were dissatisfied with the peace concluded after the Battle of Friedland. They said that had we held out a little longer, Napoleon would have been done for, as his troops had neither provisions nor ammunition. Nicholas ate and drank, chiefly the latter, in silence. He finished a couple of bottles of wine by himself. The process in his mind went on tormenting him without reaching a conclusion. He feared to give way to his thoughts, yet could not get rid of them. Suddenly, on one of the officers saying that it was humiliating to look at the French, Rostov began shouting with uncalled-for wrath, and therefore, much to the surprise of the officers, "How can you judge what's best?" he cried, the blood suddenly rushing to his face. "How can you judge the Emperor's actions? What right have we to argue? We cannot comprehend either the Emperor's aims or his actions." "But I never said a word about the Emperor," said the officer, justifying himself, and unable to understand Rostov's outburst, except on the supposition that he was drunk. But Rostov did not listen to him. "We are not diplomatic officials. We're soldiers and nothing more," he went on. "If we're ordered to die, we must die. If we're punished, it means that we have deserved it. It's not for us to judge. If the Emperor pleases to recognize Bonaparte as Emperor and to conclude an alliance with him, it means that that is the right thing to do. If once we begin judging and arguing about everything, nothing sacred will be left. That way we shall be saying there is no God. Nothing!" shouted Nicholas, banging the table, very little to the point as it seemed to his listeners, but quite relevantly to the course of his own thoughts. "Our business is to do our duty, to fight and not to think. That's all," said he. "And to drink," said one of the officers, not wishing to quarrel. "Yes, and to drink," assented Nicholas. "Hello there! Another bottle!" he shouted. Book 6, 1808-10. Chapter 1. Real Life. Prince Andrew's occupations at Bogucharovo. His drive through the forest. The bare oak. His visit to the Rostovs at Otradnoye. Overhears Natasha's talk with Sonya. Return through the forest. The oak in leaf. He decides to go to Petersburg. In 1808, the Emperor Alexander went to Erfurt for a fresh interview with the Emperor Napoleon, and in the upper circles of Petersburg, there was much talk of the grandeur of this important meeting. In 1809, the intimacy between the world's two arbiters, as Napoleon and Alexander were called, was such that when Napoleon declared war on Austria, a Russian corps crossed the frontier to cooperate with our old enemy Bonaparte against our old ally, the Emperor of Austria. And in court circles, the possibility of marriage between Napoleon and one of Alexander's sisters was spoken of. But besides considerations of foreign policy, the attention of Russian society was at that time keenly directed on the internal changes that were being undertaken in all the departments of government. Life, meanwhile, real life, with its essential interests of health and sickness, toil and rest, and its intellectual interests in thought, science, poetry, music, love, friendship, hatred, and passions, went on as usual, independently of and apart from political friendship or enmity with Napoleon Bonaparte and from all the schemes of reconstruction. Prince Andrew had spent 2 years continuously in the country. All the plans Pierre had attempted on his estates, and constantly changing from one thing to another had never accomplished, were carried out by Prince Andrew without display and without perceptible difficulty. He had in the highest degree a practical tenacity which Pierre lacked, and without fuss or strain on his part, this set things going. On one of his estates, the 300 serfs were liberated and became free agricultural laborers, this being one of the first examples of the kind in Russia. On other estates, the serfs' compulsory labor was commuted for a quit rent. A trained midwife was engaged for Boguchárovo at his expense, and a priest was paid to teach reading and writing to the children of the peasants and household serfs. Prince Andrew spent half his time at Bald Hills with his father and his son, who were still in the care of nurses. The other half he spent in Boguchárovo Cloister, as his father called Prince Andrew's estate. Despite the indifference to the affairs of the world he'd expressed to Pierre, he diligently followed all that went on, received many books, and to his surprise noticed that when he or his father had visitors from Petersburg, the very vortex of life, these people lagged behind himself, who never left the country, in knowledge of what was happening in home and foreign affairs. Besides being occupied with his estates and reading a great variety of books, Prince Andrew was at this time busy with a critical survey of our last two unfortunate campaigns and with drawing up a proposal for a reform of the army rules and regulations. In the spring of 1809, he went to visit the Ryazan estates which had been inherited by his son, whose guardian he was. Warmed by the spring sunshine, he sat in the caleche, looking at the new grass, the first leaves on the birches, and the first puffs of white spring clouds floating across the clear blue sky. He was not thinking of anything, but looked absent-mindedly and cheerfully from side to side. They crossed the ferry where he had talked with Pierre the year before. They went through the muddy village, past threshing floors and green fields of winter rye, downhill where snow still lodged near the bridge, uphill where the clay had been liquefied by the rain, past strips of stubble land and bushes touched with green here and there, and into a birch forest growing on both sides of the road. In the forest it was almost hot. No wind could be felt. The birches with their sticky green leaves were motionless, and lilac-colored flowers and the first blades of green grass were pushing up and lifting last year's leaves. The coarse evergreen color of the small fir trees scattered here and there among the birches was an unpleasant reminder of winter. On entering the forest, the horses began to snort and sweated visibly. Peter, the footman, made some remark to the coachman. The latter assented. But apparently the coachman's sympathy was not enough for Peter, and he turned on the box toward his master. "How pleasant it is, Your Excellency," he said with a respectful smile. "What? It's pleasant, Your Excellency." What is he talking about? Thought Prince Andrew. Oh, the spring, I suppose, he thought as he turned round. Yes, really everything is green already. How early. The birches and cherry and alders, too, are coming out. But the oaks show no sign yet. Ah, here is one oak. At the edge of the road stood an oak. Probably 10 times the age of the birches that formed the forest, it was 10 times as thick and twice as tall as they. It was an enormous tree, its girth twice as great as a man could embrace, and evidently long ago some of its branches had been broken off and its bark scarred. With its huge ungainly limbs sprawling unsymmetrically and its gnarled hands and fingers, it stood an aged, stern, and scornful monster among the smiling birch trees. Only the dead-looking evergreen firs dotted about in the forest and this oak refused to yield to the charm of spring, or notice either the spring or the sunshine. Spring, love, happiness, this oak seemed to say. Are you not weary of that stupid, meaningless, constantly repeated fraud? Always the same, and always a fraud. There is no spring, no sun, no happiness. Look at those cramped, dead firs, ever the same. And at me, too, sticking out my broken and barked fingers just where they have grown, whether from my back or my sides. As they have grown, so I stand. And I do not believe in your hopes and your lies. As he passed through the forest, Prince Andrew turned several times to look at that oak, as if expecting something from it. Under the oak, too, were flowers and grass. It stood among them, scowling, rigid, misshapen, and grim as ever. Yes, the oak is right 1,000 times right, thought Prince Andrew. Let others, the young, yield afresh to that fraud. But we know life. Our life is finished. A whole sequence of new thoughts, hopeless but mournfully pleasant, rose in his soul in connection with that tree. During this journey, he, as it were, considered his life afresh and arrived at his old conclusion, restful in its hopelessness, that it was not for him to begin anything anew, but that he must live out his life content to do no harm and not disturbing himself or desiring anything. Prince Andrew had to see the marshal of the nobility for the district in connection with the affairs of the Ryazan estate of which he was trustee. This marshal was Count Ilya Rostov, and in the middle of May, Prince Andrew went to visit him. It was now hot spring weather. The whole forest was already clothed in green. It was dusty and so hot that on passing near water one longed to bathe. Prince Andrew, depressed and preoccupied with the business about which he had to speak to the marshal, was driving up the avenue in the grounds of the Rostovs' house at Otradnoye. He heard merry, girlish cries behind some trees on the right, and saw a group of girls running to cross the path of his calèche. Ahead of the rest, and nearer to him, ran a dark-haired, remarkably slim, pretty girl in a yellow chintz dress, with a white handkerchief on her head, from under which loose locks of hair escaped. The girl was shouting something, but seeing that he was a stranger, ran back laughing without looking at him. Suddenly, he did not know why, he felt a pang. The day was so beautiful, the sun so bright, everything around so gay. But that slim, pretty girl did not know or wish to know of his existence, and was contented and cheerful in her own separate, probably foolish, but bright and happy life. What is she so glad about? What is she thinking of? Not of the military regulations, or of the arrangement of the Ryazan serfs' quit-rents. Of what is she thinking? Why is she so happy? Prince Andrew asked himself with instinctive curiosity. In 1809, Count Ilya Rostov was living at Otradnoye, just as he had done in former years, that is, entertaining almost the whole province with hunts, theatricals, dinners, and music. He was glad to see Prince Andrew, as he was to see any new visitor, and insisted on his staying the night. During the dull day, in the course of which he was entertained by his elderly hosts and by the more important of the visitors, the old count's house was crowded on account of an approaching name day, Prince Andrew repeatedly glanced at Natasha, gay and laughing among the younger members of the company, and asked himself each time, what is she thinking about? Why is she so glad? That night, alone in new surroundings, he was long unable to sleep. He read a while, and then put out his candle, but relit it. It was hot in the room, the inside shutters of which were closed. He was cross with the stupid old man, as he called Rostov, who had made him stay by assuring him that some necessary documents had not yet arrived from town, and he was vexed with himself for having stayed. He got up and went to the window to open it. As soon as he opened the shutters, the moonlight, as if it had long been watching for this, burst into the room. He opened the casement. The night was fresh, bright, and very still. Just before the window was a row of pollard trees, looking black on one side and with a silvery light on the other. Beneath the trees grew some kind of lush, wet, bushy vegetation with silver-lit leaves and stems here and there. Farther back, beyond the dark trees, a roof glittered with dew. To the right was a leafy tree with brilliantly white trunk and branches, and above it shone the moon, nearly at its full, in a pale, almost starless spring sky. Prince Andrew leaned his elbows on the window ledge, and his eyes rested on that sky. His room was on the first floor. Those in the rooms above were also awake. He heard female voices overhead. "Just once more," said a girlish voice above him, which Prince Andrew recognized at once. "But when are you coming to bed?" replied another voice. "I won't, I can't sleep. What's the use? Come now, for the last time." Two girlish voices sang a musical passage, the end of some song. "Oh, how lovely. Now go to sleep, and there's an end of it." "You go to sleep, but I can't," said the first voice, coming nearer to the window. She was evidently leaning right out, for the rustle of her dress and even her breathing could be heard. Everything was stone still, like the moon, and its light and the shadows. Prince Andrew, too, dared not stir, for fear of betraying his unintentional presence.
"Sonia! Sonia!"
Prince Andrew again heard the first speaker.
"Oh, how can you sleep? Only look how glorious it is! Oh, how glorious! Do wake up, Sonia!"
she said almost with tears in her voice.
"There never, never was such a lovely night before."
Sonia made some reluctant reply.
"Do just come and see what a moon! Oh, how lovely! Come here! Oh, darling, sweetheart, come here. There, you see? I feel like sitting down on my heels, putting my arms round my knees like this, straining tight as possible, and flying away. Like this.
Take care, you'll fall out." He heard the sound of a scuffle and Sonia's disapproving voice.
"It's past 1 o'clock. Oh, you only spoil things for me. All right, go on, go, go."
Again all was silent, but Prince Andrew knew she was still sitting there. From time to time he heard a soft rustle and at times a sigh.
Oh, God, what does it mean?" she suddenly exclaimed. "To bed, then, if it must be."
And she slammed the casement. "For her I might as well not exist," thought Prince Andrew, while he listened to her voice, for some reason expecting, yet fearing, that she might say something about him. "There she is again, as if it were on purpose," thought he. In his soul, there suddenly arose such an unexpected turmoil of youthful thoughts and hopes contrary to the whole tenor of his life that, unable to explain his condition to himself, he lay down and fell asleep at once. Next morning, having taken leave of no one but the Count and not waiting for the ladies to appear, Prince Andrew set off for home. It was already the beginning of June when, on his return journey, he drove into the birch forest where the gnarled old oak had made so strange and memorable an impression on him. In the forest, the harness bells sounded yet more muffled than they had done 6 weeks before, for now all was thick, shady, and dense, and the young firs dotted about in the forest did not jar on the general beauty, but, lending themselves to the mood around, were delicately green with fluffy young shoots. The whole day had been hot. Somewhere a storm was gathering, but only a small cloud had scattered some raindrops lightly, sprinkling the road and the sappy leaves. The left side of the forest was dark in the shade. The right side glittered in the sunlight, wet and shiny, and scarcely swayed by the breeze. Everything was in blossom. The nightingales trilled, and their voices reverberated, now near, now far away. Yes, here in this forest was that oak with which I agreed, thought Prince Andrew. But where is it? He again wondered, gazing at the left side of the road, and, without recognizing it, he looked with admiration at the very oak he sought. The old oak, quite transfigured, spreading out a canopy of sappy, dark green foliage, stood wrapped and slightly trembling in the rays of the evening sun. Neither gnarled fingers, nor old scars, nor old doubts and sorrows were any of them in evidence now. Through the hard, century-old bark, even where there were no twigs, leaves had sprouted such as one could hardly believe the old veteran could have produced. Yes, it is the same oak, thought Prince Andrew. And all at once he was seized by an unreasoning springtime feeling of joy and renewal. All the best moments of his life suddenly rose to his memory. Austerlitz, with the lofty heavens, his wife's dead reproachful face, Pierre at the ferry, that girl thrilled by the beauty of the night, and that night itself, and the moon, and all this rushed suddenly to his mind. No, life is not over at 31, Prince Andrew suddenly decided, finally and decisively. It is not enough for me to know what I have in me. Everyone must know it. Pierre and that young girl who wanted to fly away into the sky, everyone must know me, so that my life may not be lived for myself alone while others live so apart from it, but so that it may be reflected in them all, and they and I may live in harmony. On reaching home, Prince Andrew decided to go to Petersburg that autumn, and found all sorts of reasons for this decision. A whole series of sensible and logical considerations, showing it to be essential for him to go to Petersburg, and even to re-enter the service, kept springing up in his mind. He could not now understand how he could ever have doubted the necessity of taking an active share in life. Just as a month before, he had not understood how the idea of leaving the quiet country could ever enter his head. It now seemed clear to him that all his experience of life must be senselessly wasted unless he applied it to some kind of work and again played an active part in life. He did not even remember how formerly, on the strength of similar wretched logical arguments, it had seemed obvious that he would be degrading himself if he now, after the lessons he had had in life, allowed himself to believe in the possibility of being useful and in the possibility of happiness or love. Now, reason suggested quite the opposite. After that journey to Ryazan, he found the country dull. His former pursuits no longer interested him, and often when sitting alone in his study, he got up, went to the mirror, and gazed a long time at his own face. Then he would turn away to the portrait of his dead Lise, who, with hair curled a la grecque, looked tenderly and gaily at him out of the gilt frame. She did not now say those former terrible words to him, but looked simply, merrily, and inquisitively at him. And Prince Andrew, crossing his arms behind him, long paced the room, now frowning, now smiling, as he reflected on those irrational, inexpressible thoughts, secret as a crime, which altered his whole life, and were connected with Pierre, with fame, with the girl at the window, the oak, and woman's beauty and love. And if anyone came into his room at such moments, he was particularly cold, stern, and above all, unpleasantly logical. "My dear," Princess Mary, entering at such a moment, would say, "little Nicholas can't go out today. It's very cold." "If it were hot," Prince Andrew would reply at such times very dryly to his sister, "he would go out in his smock. But as it is cold, he must wear warm clothes, which were designed for that purpose." "That is what follows from the fact that it is cold, and not that a child who needs fresh air should remain at home," he would add with extreme logic, as if punishing someone for those secret, illogical emotions that stirred within him. At such moments, Princess Mary would think how intellectual work dries men up. Chapter 2. Speransky, Arakcheyev, and Prince Andrew. Prince Andrew arrived in Petersburg in August 1809. It was the time when the youthful Speransky was at the zenith of his fame and his reforms were being pushed forward with the greatest energy. That same August, the emperor was thrown from his calèche, injured his leg, and remained 3 weeks at Peterhof, receiving Speransky every day and no one else. At that time, the two famous decrees were being prepared that so agitated society, abolishing court ranks and introducing examinations to qualify for the grades of collegiate assessor and state counselor. And not merely these, but a whole state constitution intended to change the existing order of government in Russia, legal, administrative, and financial, from the Council of State down to the district tribunals. Now, those vague liberal dreams with which the Emperor Alexander had ascended the throne and which he had tried to put into effect with the aid of his associates Chartoryski, Novosiltsev, Kochubey, and Stroganov, whom he himself in jest had called his Comité de Salut Public, his Committee of Public Safety, were taking shape and being realized. Now all these men were replaced by Speransky on the civil side and Arakcheyev on the military. Soon after his arrival, Prince Andrew, as a gentleman of the chamber, presented himself at court and at a levee. The emperor, though he met him twice, did not favor him with a single word. It had always seemed to Prince Andrew before that he was antipathetic to the emperor, and that the latter disliked his face and personality generally. And in the cold, repellent glance the emperor gave him, he now found further confirmation of this surmise. The courtiers explained the emperor's neglect of him by His Majesty's displeasure at Bolkonski's not having served since 1805. I know myself that one cannot help one's sympathies and antipathies, thought Prince Andrew. So it will not do to present my proposal for the reform of the army regulations to the emperor personally, but the project will speak for itself. He mentioned what he had written to an old field marshal, a friend of his father's. The field marshal made an appointment to see him, received him graciously, and promised to inform the emperor. A few days later, Prince Andrew received notice that he was to go to see the Minister of War, Count Arakcheyev. On the appointed day, Prince Andrew entered Count Arakcheyev's waiting room at 9 in the morning. He did not know Arakcheyev personally, had never seen him, and all he had heard of him inspired him with but little respect for the man. His Minister of War, a man trusted by the emperor, and I need not concern myself about his personal qualities. He has been commissioned to consider my project, so he alone can get it adopted, thought Prince Andrew, as he waited among a number of important and unimportant people in Count Arakcheyev's waiting room. During his service, chiefly as an adjutant, Prince Andrew had seen the anterooms of many important men, and the different types of such rooms were well known to him. Count Arakcheyev's anteroom had quite a special character. The faces of the unimportant people awaiting their turn for an audience showed embarrassment and civility. The faces of those of higher rank expressed a common feeling of awkwardness covered by a mask of unconcern and ridicule of themselves, their situation, and the person for whom they were waiting. Some walked thoughtfully up and down, others whispered and laughed. Prince Andrew heard the nickname Sila Andreevich and the words, "Uncle will give it to us hot," in reference to Count Arakcheyev. Note, his real name was Alexei Andreevich Arakcheyev. In Russian, many shades of feeling may be expressed by various uses of a man's Christian name, surname, and patronymic. The substitution of Sila, force, for Alexei, indicated the speaker's conception of Arakcheyev's leading characteristic. One general, an important personage, evidently feeling offended at having to wait so long, sat crossing and uncrossing his legs and smiling contemptuously to himself. But the moment the door opened, one feeling alone appeared on all faces, that of fear.
Prince Andrew, for the second time, asked the adjutant on duty to take in his name, but received an ironical look and was told that his turn would come in due course. After some others had been shown in and out of the minister's room by the adjutant on duty, an officer who struck Prince Andrew by his humiliated and frightened air was admitted at that terrible door. This officer's audience lasted a long time. Then, suddenly, the grating sound of a harsh voice was heard from the other side of the door, and the officer, with pale face and trembling lips, came out and passed through the waiting room, clutching his head. After this, Prince Andrew was conducted to the door, and the officer on duty said in a whisper, "To the right, at the window." Prince Andrew entered a plain, tidy room, and saw at the table a man of 40 with a long waist, a long, closely cropped head, deep wrinkles, scowling brows above dull, greenish-hazel eyes, and an overhanging red nose. Alexeyev turned his head toward him without looking at him. "What is your petition?" asked Alexeyev. "I'm not petitioning, Your Excellency," returned Prince Andrew quietly. Alexeyev's eyes turned toward him. "Sit down," said he. "Prince Bolkonsky?" "I'm not petitioning about anything. His Majesty the Emperor has deigned to send Your Excellency a project submitted by me."
"You see, my dear sir, I have read your project," interrupted Alexeyev, uttering only the first words amiably, and then, again without looking at Prince Andrew, relapsing gradually into a tone of grumbling contempt. "You're proposing new military laws? There are many laws, but no one to carry out the old ones. Nowadays everybody designs laws. It is easier writing than doing."
"I came at His Majesty the Emperor's wish to learn from Your Excellency how you propose to deal with the memorandum I presented," said Prince Andrew politely.
"I have endorsed a resolution on your memorandum and sent it to the committee." "I do not approve of it," said Alexeyev, rising and taking a paper from his writing table. "Here," and he handed it to Prince Andrew.
Across the paper was scrawled in pencil, without capital letters, misspelled, and without punctuation, "Unsoundly constructed because resembles an imitation of the French military code, and from the articles of war needlessly deviating." "To what committee has the memorandum been referred?" inquired Prince Andrew.
"To the Committee on Army Regulations. I have recommended that Your Honor should be appointed a member, but without a salary."
Prince Andrew smiled. "I don't want one."
"A member without salary," repeated Alexeyev. "I have the honor... Hey, call the next one. Who else is there?" he shouted, bowing to Prince Andrew.
While waiting for the announcement of his appointment to the committee, Prince Andrew looked up his former acquaintances, particularly those he knew to be in power and whose aid he might need. In Petersburg, he now experienced the same feeling he had had on the eve of a battle, when troubled by anxious curiosity and irresistibly attracted to the ruling circles, where the future, on which the fate of millions depended, was being shaped. From the irritation of the older men, the curiosity of the uninitiated, the reserve of the initiated, the hurry and preoccupation of everyone, and the innumerable committees and commissions of whose existence he learned every day, he felt that now, in 1809, here in Petersburg, a vast civil conflict was in preparation, the commander-in-chief of which was a mysterious person he did not know, but who was supposed to be a man of genius, Speransky. And this movement of reconstruction, of which Prince Andrew had a vague idea, and Speransky its chief promoter, began to interest him so keenly that the question of the army regulations quickly receded to a secondary place in his consciousness. Prince Andrew was most favorably placed to secure a good reception in the highest and most diverse Petersburg circles of the day. The reforming party cordially welcomed and courted him, in the first place because he was reputed to be clever and very well read, and secondly, because by liberating his serfs he had obtained the reputation of being a liberal. The party of the old and dissatisfied, who censured the innovations, turned to him expecting his sympathy and their disapproval of the reforms, simply because he was the son of his father. The feminine society world welcomed him gladly because he was rich, distinguished, a good match, and almost a newcomer, with a halo of romance on account of his supposed death and the tragic loss of his wife. Besides this, the general opinion of all who had known him previously was that he had greatly improved during these last 5 years, having softened and grown more manly, lost his former affectation, pride, and contemptuous irony, and acquired the serenity that comes with years. People talked about him, were interested in him, and wanted to meet him. The day after his interview with Count Arakcheyev, Prince Andrew spent the evening at Count Kochubey's. He told the Count of his interview with Sila Andreevich. Kochubey spoke of Arakcheyev by that nickname, with the same vague irony Prince Andrew had noticed in the Minister of War's anteroom.
"Mon cher, even in this case, you can't do without Michael Mikhailovich Speransky. He manages everything. I'll speak to him. He has promised to come this evening."
"What has Speransky to do with the army regulations?" asked Prince Andrew.
Kochubey shook his head smilingly, as if surprised at Bolkonsky's simplicity. "We were talking to him about you a few days ago," Kochubey continued, "and about your freed ploughman."
"Oh, is it you, Prince, who have freed your serfs?" said an old man of Catherine's day, turning contemptuously toward Bolkonsky.
"It was a small estate that brought in no profit," replied Prince Andrew, trying to extenuate his action so as not to irritate the old man uselessly.
"Afraid of being late," said the old man, looking at Kochubey. "There's one thing I don't understand," he continued. "Who will plough the land if they're set free? It is easy to write laws, but difficult to rule. Just the same as now, I ask you, Count, who will be heads of the departments when everybody has to pass examinations?"
"Those who pass the examinations, I suppose," replied Kochubey, crossing his legs and glancing round.
"Well, I have Pryanichnikov serving under me, a splendid man, a priceless man, but he's 60. Is he to go up for examination?"
"Yes, that's a difficulty, as education is not at all general. But
Count Kochubey did not finish. He rose, took Prince Andrew by the arm, and went to meet a tall, bald, fair man of about 40, with a large open forehead and a long face of unusual and peculiar whiteness, who was just entering. The newcomer wore a blue swallowtail coat with a cross suspended from his neck and a star on his left breast. It was Speransky. Prince Andrew recognized him at once and felt a throb within him, as happens at critical moments of life. Whether it was from respect, envy, or anticipation, he did not know. Speransky's whole figure was of a peculiar type that made him easily recognizable. In the society in which Prince Andrew lived, he had never seen anyone who, together with awkward and clumsy gestures, possessed such calmness and self-assurance. He had never seen so resolute yet gentle an expression as that in those half-closed, rather humid eyes, or so firm a smile that expressed nothing. Nor had he heard such a refined, smooth, soft voice. Above all, he had never seen such delicate whiteness of face or hands, hands which were broad, but very plump, soft, and white. Such whiteness and softness Prince Andrew had only seen on the faces of soldiers who had been long in hospital. This was Speransky, Secretary of State, reporter to the Emperor and his companion at Erfurt, where he had more than once met and talked with Napoleon. Speransky did not shift his eyes from one face to another as people involuntarily do on entering a large company, and was in no hurry to speak. He spoke slowly, with assurance that he would be listened to, and he looked only at the person with whom he was conversing. Prince Andrew followed Speransky's every word and movement with particular attention. As happens to some people, especially to men who judge those near to them severely, he always, on meeting anyone new, especially anyone whom, like Speransky, he knew by reputation, expected to discover in him the perfection of human qualities. Speransky told Kochubey he was sorry he had been unable to come sooner, as he had been detained at the palace. He did not say that the Emperor had kept him, and Prince Andrew noticed this affectation of modesty. When Kochubey introduced Prince Andrew, Speransky slowly turned his eyes to Bolkonsky with his customary smile and looked at him in silence.
I'm very glad to make your acquaintance. I had heard of you, as everyone has, he said after a pause. Kochubey said a few words about the reception Alekcheyev had given Bolkonsky. Speransky smiled more markedly. The chairman of the Committee on Army Regulations is my good friend Monsieur Magnitsky, he said, fully articulating every word and syllable. And if you like, I can put you in touch with him. He paused at the full stop. I hope you will find him sympathetic and ready to cooperate in promoting all that is reasonable. A circle soon formed round Speransky, and the old man who had talked about his subordinate Pryanichnikov addressed a question to him. Prince Andrew, without joining in the conversation, watched every movement of Speransky's. This man, not long since an insignificant divinity student, who now, Bolkonsky thought, held in his hands, those plump white hands, the fate of Russia. Prince Andrew was struck by the extraordinarily disdainful composure with which Speransky answered the old man. He appeared to address condescending words to him from an immeasurable height. When the old man began to speak too loud, Speransky smiled and said he could not judge of the advantage or disadvantage of what pleased the sovereign. Having talked for a little while in the general circle, Speransky rose and, coming up to Prince Andrew, took him along to the other end of the room. It was clear that he thought it necessary to interest himself in Bolkonsky. I had no chance to talk with you, Prince, during the animated conversation in which that venerable gentleman involved me, he said with a mildly contemptuous smile, as if intimating by that smile that he and Prince Andrew understood the insignificance of the people with whom he had just been talking. This flattered Prince Andrew. I've known of you for a long time, first from your action with regard to your serfs, the first example of which it is very desirable that there should be more imitators, and secondly, because you are one of those gentlemen of the chamber who have not considered themselves offended by the new decree concerning the ranks allotted to courtiers, which is causing so much gossip and tittle-tattle. No, said Prince Andrew, my father did not wish me to take advantage of the privilege. I began the service from the lower grade. Your father, a man of the last century, evidently stands above our contemporaries who so condemn this measure which merely re-establishes natural justice. I think, however, that these condemnations have some ground, returned Prince Andrew, trying to resist Speransky's influence, of which he began to be conscious. He did not like to agree with him in everything, and felt a wish to contradict. Though he usually spoke easily and well, he felt a difficulty in expressing himself now while talking with Speransky. He was too much absorbed in observing the famous man's personality. Grounds of personal ambition, maybe, Speransky put in quietly. And of state interest to some extent, said Prince Andrew. What do you mean? Asked Speransky quietly, lowering his eyes. I'm an admirer of Montesquieu, replied Prince Andrew, and his idea that le principe des monarchies et l'honneur me paraît incontestable. Certains droits et privilèges de la noblesse me paraissent être des moyens de soutenir ce sentiment. That the principle of monarchies is honor seems to me incontestable. Certain rights and privileges for the aristocracy appear to me a means of maintaining that sentiment. The smile vanished from Speransky's white face, which was much improved by the change. Probably Prince Andrew's thought interested him. Si vous envisagez la question sous ce point de vue, if you regard the question from that point of view, he began, pronouncing French with evident difficulty and speaking even slower than in Russian, but quite calmly. Speransky went on to say that honor, l'honneur, cannot be upheld by privileges harmful to the service, that honor, l'honneur, is either a negative concept of not doing what is blameworthy, or it is a source of emulation in pursuit of commendation and rewards which recognize it. His arguments were concise, simple, and clear. An institution upholding honor, the source of emulation, is one similar to the Légion d'honneur of the great Emperor Napoleon, not harmful, but helpful to the success of the service, but not a class or court privilege. I do not dispute that, But it cannot be denied that court privileges have attained the same end, returned Prince Andrew. Every courtier considers himself bound to maintain his position worthily. Yet you do not care to avail yourself of the privilege, Prince, said Speransky, indicating by a smile that he wished to finish amiably an argument which was embarrassing for his companion. If you will do me the honor of calling on me on Wednesday, he added, I will, after talking with Magnitsky, let you know what may interest you, and shall also have the pleasure of a more detailed chat with you. Closing his eyes, he bowed a la française without taking leave, and, trying to attract as little attention as possible, he left the room. During the first weeks of his stay in Petersburg, Prince Andrew felt the whole trend of thought he had formed during his life of seclusion quite overshadowed by the trifling cares that engrossed him in that city. On returning home in the evening, he would jot down in his notebook 4 or 5 necessary calls or appointments for certain hours. The mechanism of life, the arrangement of the day so as to be in time everywhere, absorbed the greater part of his vital energy. He did nothing, did not even think or find time to think, but only talked, and talked successfully, of what he had thought while in the country. He sometimes noticed with dissatisfaction that he repeated the same remark on the same day in different circles. But he was so busy for whole days together that he had no time to notice that he was thinking of nothing. As he had done on their first meeting at Kochubey's, Speransky produced a strong impression on Prince Andrew on the Wednesday when he received him tête-à-tête at his own house and talked to him long and confidentially. To Bolkonski, so many people appeared contemptible and insignificant creatures, and he so longed to find in someone the living ideal of that perfection toward which he strove, that he readily believed that in Speransky he had found this ideal of a perfectly rational and virtuous man. Had Speransky sprung from the same class as himself and possessed the same breeding and traditions, Bolkonski would soon have discovered his weak, human, unheroic sides. But as it was, Speransky's strange and logical turn of mind inspired him with respect all the more because he did not quite understand him. Moreover, Speransky, either because he appreciated the other's capacity or because he considered it necessary to win him to his side, showed off his dispassionate calm reasonableness before Prince Andrew and flattered him with that subtle flattery which goes hand in hand with self-assurance and consists in a tacit assumption that one's companion is the only man besides oneself capable of understanding the folly of the rest of mankind and the reasonableness and profundity of one's own ideas. During their long conversation on Wednesday evening, Speransky more than once remarked, "We regard everything that is above the common level of rooted custom," or with a smile, "But we want the wolves to be fed and the sheep to be safe," or, "They cannot understand this," and all in a way that seemed to say, "We, you and I, understand what they are and who we are." This first long conversation with Speransky only strengthened in Prince Andrew the feeling he had experienced toward him at their first meeting. He saw in him a remarkable, clear-thinking man of vast intellect, who by his energy and persistence had attained power, which he was using solely for the welfare of Russia. In Prince Andrew's eyes, Speransky was the man he would himself have wished to be, one who explained all the facts of life reasonably, considered important only what was rational, and was capable of applying the standard of reason to everything. Everything seemed so simple and clear in Speransky's exposition that Prince Andrew involuntarily agreed with him about everything. If he replied and argued, it was only because he wished to maintain his independence and not submit to Speransky's opinions entirely. Everything was right, and everything was as it should be. Only one thing disconcerted Prince Andrew. This was Speransky's cold, mirror-like look, which did not allow one to penetrate to his soul, and his delicate white hands, which Prince Andrew involuntarily watched as one does watch the hands of those who possess power. This mirror-like gaze and those delicate hands irritated Prince Andrew, he knew not why. He was unpleasantly struck, too, by the excessive contempt for others that he observed in Speransky, and by the diversity of lines of argument he used to support his opinions. He made use of every kind of mental device except analogy, and passed too boldly, it seemed to Prince Andrew, from one to another. Now he would take up the position of a practical man and condemn dreamers, now that of a satirist and laugh ironically at his opponents, now grow severely logical, or suddenly rise to the realm of metaphysics. This last resource was one he very frequently employed. He would transfer a question to metaphysical heights, pass on to definitions of space, time, and thought, and having deduced the refutation he needed, would again descend to the level of the original discussion. In general, the trait of Speransky's mentality which struck Prince Andrew most was his absolute and unshakable belief in the power and authority of reason. It was evident that the thought could never occur to him which to Prince Andrew seemed so natural, namely, that it is after all impossible to express all one thinks, and that he had never felt the doubt, is not all I think and believe nonsense? And it was just this peculiarity of Speransky's mind that particularly attracted Prince Andrew. During the first period of their acquaintance, Bolkonski felt a passionate admiration for him similar to that which he had once felt for Bonaparte. The fact that Speransky was the son of a village priest, and that stupid people might meanly despise him on account of his humble origin, as in fact many did, caused Prince Andrew to cherish his sentiment for him the more, and unconsciously to strengthen it. On that first evening Bolkonski spent with him, having mentioned the commission for the revision of the Code of Laws, Speransky told him sarcastically that the commission had existed for 150 years, had cost millions, and had done nothing except that Rosenkampf had stuck labels on the corresponding paragraphs of the different codes. "And that is all the state has for the millions it has spent," said he. "We want to give the Senate new juridical powers, but we have no laws. That is why it is a sin for men like you, Prince, not to serve in these times." Prince Andrew said that for that work an education in jurisprudence was needed, which he did not possess. "But nobody possesses it. So what would you have? It is a vicious circle from which we must break a way out." A week later, Prince Andrew was a member of the Committee on Army Regulations, and, what he had not at all expected, was chairman of a section of the committee for the revision of the laws. At Speransky's request, he took the first part of the civil code that was being drawn up, and with the aid of the Code Napoleon and the Institutes of Justinian, he worked at formulating the section on personal rights. Chapter 3. Pierre and the Petersburg Freemasons. He visits Joseph Alexeyevich. Reconciliation with Hélène. Nearly 2 years before this, in 1808, Pierre, on returning to Petersburg after visiting his estates, had involuntarily found himself in a leading position among the Petersburg Freemasons. He arranged dining and funeral lodge meetings, enrolled new members, and busied himself uniting various lodges and acquiring authentic charters. He gave money for the erection of temples and supplemented as far as he could the collection of alms, in regard to which the majority of members were stingy and irregular. He supported almost single-handed a poorhouse the order had founded in Petersburg. His life, meanwhile, continued as before, with the same infatuations and dissipations. He liked to dine and drink well, and though he considered it immoral and humiliating, could not resist the temptations of the bachelor circles in which he moved. Amid the turmoil of his activities and distractions, however, Pierre, at the end of a year, began to feel that the more firmly he tried to rest upon it, the more Masonic ground on which he stood gave way under him. At the same time, he felt that the deeper the ground sank under him, the closer bound he involuntarily became to the order. When he had joined the Freemasons, he had experienced the feeling of one who confidently steps onto the smooth surface of a bog. When he put his foot down, it sank in. To make quite sure of the firmness of the ground, he put his other foot down and sank deeper still, became stuck in it, and involuntarily waded knee-deep in the bog. Joseph Alexeyevich was not in Petersburg. He had of late stood aside from the affairs of the Petersburg lodges and lived almost entirely in Moscow. All the members of the lodges were men Pierre knew in ordinary life, and it was difficult for him to regard them merely as brothers in Freemasonry and not as Prince B or Ivan Vasilievich D, whom he knew in society mostly as weak and insignificant men. Under the Masonic aprons and insignia, he saw the uniforms and decorations at which they aimed in ordinary life. Often, after collecting arms and reckoning up 20 to 30 rubles received for the most part in promises from a dozen members, of whom half were as well able to pay as himself, Pierre remembered the Masonic vow in which each brother promised to devote all his belongings to his neighbor, and doubts on which he tried not to dwell arose in his soul. He divided the brothers he knew into four categories. In the first, he put those who did not take an active part in the affairs of the lodges or in human affairs, but were exclusively occupied with the mystical science of the order, with questions of the threefold designation of God, the three primordial elements, sulfur, mercury, and salt, or the meaning of the square and all the various figures of the Temple of Solomon. Pierre respected this class of brothers to which the elder ones chiefly belonged, including, Pierre thought, Joseph Alexeyevich himself. But he did not share their interests. His heart was not in the mystical aspect of Freemasonry. In the second category, Pierre reckoned himself and others like him, seeking and vacillating, who had not yet found in Freemasonry a straight and comprehensible path, but hoped to do so. In the third category, he included those brothers, the majority, who saw nothing in Freemasonry but the external forms and ceremonies, and prized the strict performance of these forms without troubling about their purport or significance. Such were Villarsky and even the Grand Master of the Principal Lodge. Finally, to the fourth category also, a great many brothers belonged, particularly those who had lately joined. These, according to Pierre's observations, were men who had no belief in anything, nor desire for anything, but joined the Freemasons merely to associate with the wealthy young brothers who were influential through their connections or rank, and of whom there were very many in the lodge. Pierre began to feel dissatisfied with what he was doing. Freemasonry, at any rate as he saw it here, sometimes seemed to him based merely on externals. He did not think of doubting Freemasonry itself, but suspected that Russian Masonry had taken a wrong path and deviated from its original principles. And so, toward the end of the year, he went abroad to be initiated into the higher secrets of the order. In the summer of 1809, Pierre returned to Petersburg. Our Freemasons knew from correspondence with those abroad that Bezukhov had obtained the confidence of many highly placed persons, had been initiated into many mysteries, had been raised to a higher grade, and was bringing back with him much that might conduce to the advantage of the Masonic cause in Russia. The Petersburg Freemasons all came to see him, tried to ingratiate themselves with him, and it seemed to them all that he was preparing something for them and concealing it. A solemn meeting of the Lodge of the Second Degree was convened, at which Pierre promised to communicate to the Petersburg brothers what he had to deliver to them from the highest leaders of their order. The meeting was a full one. After the usual ceremonies, Pierre rose and began his address. "Dear brothers," he began, blushing and stammering, with a written speech in his hand, "it is not sufficient to observe our mysteries in the seclusion of our lodge. We must act. Act. We are drowsing, but we must act." Pierre raised his notebook and began to read. "For the dissemination of pure truth and to secure the triumph of virtue," he read, "we must cleanse men from prejudice, diffuse principles in harmony with the spirit of the times, undertake the education of the young, unite ourselves in indissoluble bonds with the wisest men, boldly yet prudently overcome superstitions, infidelity, and folly, and form of those devoted to us a body linked together by unity of purpose and possessed of authority and power. To attain this end, we must secure a preponderance of virtue over vice, and must endeavor to secure that the honest man may, even in this world, receive a lasting reward for his virtue. But in these great endeavors, we are gravely hampered by the political institutions of today. What is to be done in these circumstances? To favor revolutions? Overthrow everything? Repel force by force? No, we are very far from that. Every violent reform deserves censure, for it quite fails to remedy evil while men remain what they are, and also because wisdom needs no violence. The whole plan of our order should be based on the idea of preparing men of firmness and virtue bound together by unity of conviction, aiming at the punishment of vice and folly, and patronizing talent and virtue, raising worthy men from the dust and attaching them to our brotherhood. Only then will our order have the power unobtrusively to bind the hands of the protectors of disorder and to control them without their being aware of it. In a word, we must found a form of government holding universal sway, which should be diffused over the whole world without destroying the bonds of citizenship, and beside which all other governments can continue in their customary course and do everything except what impedes the great aim of our order, which is to obtain for virtue the victory over vice. This aim was that of Christianity itself. It taught men to be wise and good, and for their own benefit to follow the example and instruction of the best and wisest men. At that time, when everything was plunged in darkness, preaching alone was of course sufficient. The novelty of truth endowed her with special strength, but now we need much more powerful methods.